Welcome to Zur Institute LLC audio recording on telehealth. I am your host, Nola Nordmarken. I am a marriage and family therapist in Southern California with offices in Santa Monica and South Pasadena. I have also co-authored CEU courses with Dr. Zur, including such topics as touch and psychotherapy, home office practice, and the professional will. In this program, I will be interviewing Dr. Ofer Zur on his views and understanding on telehealth or telemental health. This recording is part of an online course on telehealth by the Zur Institute at www.zurinstitute.com. Ofer Zur is a licensed psychologist, fellow of American Psychological Association, instructor, lecturer, ethics consultant, and expert witness with a private practice in Sonoma, California. He has been in practice for over 20 years and is director of the Zur Institute, LLC at, again, www.zurinstitute.com, which offers over 130 innovative and challenging online continuing education courses for psychologists, counselors, social workers, nurses, and other mental health practitioners. Dr. Zur is most known for his effort to humanize the field of psychotherapy and counseling, and he is a fierce advocate of appropriate and flexible application of therapeutic boundaries. He has been a visionary in the field. In the 80s, warning us about the potential problems with managed care, and he has taught many of us how to practice outside managed care on a fee-for-service basis. In 1990, he was a strong advocate of humanizing the field of psychotherapy and counseling and taught us how to apply therapeutic boundaries with flexibility and care rather than rigidity and fear, allowing us to tailor boundaries according to the fluctuating
clinical needs of each client. In 2002, he saw HIPAA coming our way and wrote the compliance.
He shifted his attention to telehealth, or telemental health, which he views as one of the most important developments in our field of psychotherapy and counseling. And wow, it is a rapidly expanding field. In this unique audio, or may I say pioneer recording, Dr. Zur will explore the complexities of what we do and do not know regarding telehealth. And because we're pioneers, it's a little bit like the American Wild West. The laws and ethics develop in response to what's happening now and next in very rapid succession. Is it okay for me to call you Ofer for the rest of this interview?
Yes, Nola, yeah, absolutely.
This might just be the easiest question I have for you today. Can you define for us what is telehealth e-therapy? Or telemedicine?
Yes, and thank you for a really generous introduction. Telehealth has also been referred to as telemedicine. It refers to the general terms of delivery of medicine or mental health services via digital means in a non-in-person situation. Another definition is telemedicine is the use of electronic communication and information technologies to provide and support clinical care at a distance. Yet, one more definition, the use of telecommunication and information technology to provide access to health intervention, consultation, assessment, supervision, education, and information across distances. When it comes to psychology, counseling, and mental health services, it has been called telemental health, telepsychology, e-counseling, e-psychotherapy, telepsychiatrist, internet-based psychotherapy, and many other names. Even some people call it teleanalysis for conducting psychoanalytic psychotherapy via telehealth technology. What's important to understand that telehealth can be delivered in a variety of ways. It can be delivered by phone, email, text, chat, video conferencing, virtual realities, And who knows, in other futuristic ways, it's probably just waiting around the corner. It can be conducted synchronistically, meaning at the same time, such as on phone or video conferencing, or it can be conducted asynchronistically, meaning sequentially, like in text, email, or chats.
It's pretty amazing to think of, if we were to fast forward just 5 years from now, how different the definition might be, or really how different the delivery might be.
Absolutely. Kind of, you know, it's like we didn't think about smartphones a few years ago, or Kindle or iPads, and there's so many new technologies around the corner, and they're going to get faster and smaller.
And it's really a challenge just to kind of keep up with the rapid changes. I'm also aware, when I think about this, that so much in our profession is limited by state boundaries and from profession to profession. How would this alter the definition, if at all?
You know, it's a good question. The answer is yes. It may vary from state to state. However, many states and some organizations have not attended to the issue of mental health altogether. For example, California is a state that did attend to telehealth and define it. And in this state, therapy via the phone is not considered telehealth. But this is kind of, this line will be soon be kind of disappearing, as therapy, so much of therapy will be happening online, so we won't necessarily need even new regulation necessarily, but this is something to be seen.
You know, I've heard you use the terms digital native and digital immigrant, the natives being those younger people who were born into the digital world, and the immigrants, those of us who were born before it and are kind of immigrating into it and finding out about it. As we're talking, what are some of the reasons that telehealth is so important? And I'm guessing, I just got a book suggestion from Amazon the other day, and it was called The New Millennials and How They're Reshaping the World. And these are the 20-somethings and younger who are really the natives who are born in. They're very, very adaptive. And I was surprised to find out that it's a group that's actually larger than the baby boomer generation. So I have a hunch that in your response you're going to talk to me about what psychotherapy is going to mean in relating to the people that are the natives. But why should we psychotherapists and counselors become aware or gain knowledge in this arena? What are some reasons?
You know, you already answered it in a beautiful way. The future is here with the new millennium, or what the digital natives that you mentioned, that my daughter and I has been writing about quite a bit. And the short answer for your question is that telehealth is probably the most important development in our field. It's a way of the future, and the future is here. With 700 million people on Facebook, people learn to socialize online, to gather information, to communicate, to socialize, to find future mate, to do sex. And they're going to get their medical needs online as well. Medicine has been shifting to telemedicine for quite some time. Physician can check, can do remote check on vital signs, and even do remote surgery. And when it comes to mental health, there are so many reasons that it is important. The shortage of therapists in rural area. We baby boomers are going to want to be served at home, and we are going, many of us that are adoptive digital immigrants are liking to do things online, to socialize, especially the young ones, as I mentioned. The homebound people, whether they're at home due to anxiety or disability, will need to use telehealth. I'm thinking about young LGBT who are ready to come out, and no reason in the world are going to talk to somebody local about the coming out, with all the homophobia that is so prevalent in the world. Prisons is another place where instead of moving prisoners or moving doctors around or therapists around, you do it via telemental health. It's already implemented. Needless to say, the military, the treatment of post-traumatic stress in rural Afghanistan can be done easily via telehealth. And most importantly, as where you started the question, people are getting used to socialize, get help, shop, do banking, and everything else online. So medicine and psychotherapy is not any different. So this is why every psychotherapist who wants to stay in business will need to learn about this important, evolving, and for me, exciting field.
You know, it is so interesting, and none of us really know exactly where it's going to go. But I also think about how people are changing their attitudes about commuting from suburban communities to the urban areas for work, and how there's a trend toward local communities and having that happen on many, many levels. And this might support that as well.
Absolutely, yeah. People will create a community online, and it will be a difference than, you know, our little villages. But it's definitely a very powerful community that can change the regime in many countries, and perhaps even hopefully in this country.
So I know that this audio recording will be featured in the Azure Institute's Continuing Education Online course on telehealth. Can you tell us what will be included in the course?
This is probably one of the most comprehensive courses on the topic that is available. There are a few others that are also very good. The course includes 7 audio interviews with experts, and it will cover some of the hottest issue in the field, cross state lines, when you and I may be talking to somebody who does not live in California, reimbursement issues. Can therapists use Skype in telehealth? There's a huge debate about it, whether Skype is HIPAA compliant or not, issues of informed consent, a issue of verification of the client. How do we know that we are talking to a 16 years old or a 90 years old? Clinical consideration of what clients are suited for this kind of work, what condition, what mental disorders, what kind of setting, whether it's rural, prison, psychoanalytic practices, and many other ethical, clinical, and legal questions will be covered in the course. Then the course will provide probably one of the most comprehensive resource page with extra link to articles, regulation, code of ethics, important organization, bibliography. So it's going to be a very comprehensive course. I'm very excited about it.
You know, that it is very exciting, too. And for me as a practitioner, it feels like we're feeling our way in the dark with a lot of this. So any guidance that we can get is really helpful. I know because it's such a new and pioneering field, sometimes there seem to be more questions than answers. But it's really wonderful to be able to talk about it and open up communication and get some information.
Beautifully said. And you know what we need to do is to tolerate sometimes that we don't know the answer. In our field, whenever we don't know something, we are so fast to say, oh, it's unethical or it's illegal, without any kind of base for that. We need to tolerate not to know the answer. Personally, as you know, I love not knowing the answer. It gives me juice, it gives me meaning, it gives me incentive to explore. But there is very little tolerance among our ranks for people not to know, because people just feel at ease knowing, is it right, is it wrong, is it ethical or is it unethical? And when it comes to telehealth, so many of the questions, as we'll discuss today, are kind of still up in the air. And so I'm encouraging the listeners just to dare not to know. Some things are clear and some things aren't, and we need to know the difference.
I'm so glad you're comfortable with the questions over, because a lot of us out here are really wanting answers to make us feel more secure in what we do. So this is a course that I think will be really helpful to a lot of us. You know, I have some questions. I have some thoughts. Let's assume that I have seen a client for a long time in California where I'm licensed. The client gets a job requiring him to travel extensively throughout the U.S. and abroad. So he asks me to continue to do therapy with him via phone and video conferencing technology. Can I legally and ethically provide telehealth to such a client?
So we'll separate. Let's make sure that the parameter of the questions are clear. This is a client who resides in California, who travels throughout the United States or abroad. I have a few clients like that. One is a train engineer, and he calls me from the train as he crosses from state to state. And another one is a pilot who may call me from Hawaii or Beijing or Seattle or Detroit. In both of this situation, the residents of this client are still in California where I am licensed. So if the client's residency has not changed and they still reside and pay his bills and his mortgage and PG&E, whatever, rent in California, that means he's a resident of California and I can treat him regardless of where he is on the planet, whether it's on a sailboat or to Hawaii or while he travels. So this is a question. I answer the question for somebody who travels but still reside in California.
So here's another question. I have had this come up several times with adolescents that I've worked with who live in California and go to college in a different state, and they're actually residing in their dorms most of the year in another state, but they come home during holidays and summer breaks to be with their parents in their parents' homes. How would that affect the
Let me backtrack a little bit for the people who travel for work or for fun. Because I think your original question was happen if you get a call from somebody from a different state. So perhaps let me answer this one because this is a very important aspect. So you get a call from somebody who live in another state where you and I are not licensed. What do you do? And this is kind of a very, very important question, as if we are not licensed in the state where this client reside, we need to know what the licensing law in this state, and all states in the United States have licensing laws. So most probably we cannot treat this client across state line if he is permanently and constantly reside in another state where we are not licensed. We need to find out what's the licensing law in the client's state. But most probably, this is one thing we cannot do yet. Now, this is very archaic and very nonsensical law, but it's part of the American structure and the independence of each state to make its own laws. But, you know, what is the big deal about me living 1 mile away from in one state or in New Jersey, but not licensed in New York, and I'll treat somebody from the other side of the tunnel? So we need to be very careful with that. Now, the question is, let's say that if somebody decides to treat the clients anyway, if I treat somebody in California, if outside California in a state where I'm not licensed and there is some problem, California Licensing Board will not do anything about it. They don't have a say about it because the client is not a resident in California. The other state licensing board, I highly doubt that they are going to try to extradite me to the other state and spend $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 to extradite me and to take me to court because I treated a client from their states from a panic attack via phone or Skype. So the other concerns about do I know about child abuse reporting in the other states and many other concerns. So we need to be very cautious when we get calls from clients from states where we are not licensed. Nursing has
How about other countries?
Other countries depends if they have any licensing laws there. Many countries, you know, somebody asked me about Sri Lanka the other day. They don't have licensing laws in Sri Lanka. So you don't break any laws to treat somebody in Sri Lanka. And we need to make sure to understand the California licensing board will not get involved if I treat somebody in Sri Lanka, because this is not where the mandate is supposed to mandate to protect people in California, not to deal with people in Sri Lanka. So, but let's go back now to the questions that you asked about the college students. This is where you walk us into the gray area. Because the question then becomes, is this young college student is a resident of the state where he or she goes to college, or they are a resident of still in California where you and I are licensed? So what we need to think about is three aspects. What is the best interest of the client? Because continuity of care can be very important. If the client is suicidal or the client will not match with another therapist very easily, what is the residency status? And what is the licensing law of telehealth in the states where the clients go to college? So if the client's distrusting other therapies and will not start therapy with somebody else, I can make a point of continuity of care that it can be highly beneficial, at least initially, to continue to work with the clients and then to try to help them get local therapy from college counseling centers that are likely to be more knowledgeable regarding local resources, including support group, vocational counseling, psychiatric emergency, etc. The second issue is, what is residency? And this is where the gray area is.
Can we back up just a little bit?
Sure.
It sounds as if you're saying that the goal would be transition. So are you saying that it would be not okay to say, okay, you're going away to college and we'll go ahead and continue with our regular sessions as we have had them scheduled, and when you come home, you'll see me at home?
We don't know that. No, I'm not sure. It can be transition or it cannot be transition. This leads us to the second question, is what is the residency of a client who go to college but come to visit? Like my son just left to college and he already visited two times and we are not even in Thanksgiving. So and every time they come back, they may see us in counseling. So some people suggest, what is a residency requirement by the college they're going to? But this is not a legal status. So the answer for that is, we really don't know what is permanent residence. We don't have a case law about defining it. So the answer is, it's one of these gray areas that you need to look at these three components that I said. What's good for the client clinically, what residency status, how you define it, who defines it, and what's the licensing law. One way to do is to check with the licensing board of where the clients go to college, of the state where the client go to college, and they may be able to give you guidance. My sense, it's probably are as much in the dark in some regard, because it's such a new area that hopefully we'll get some more clarity in the next few years. But it's so you need to think about this three component, and as I always say, consult, consult, and consult.
Can you think of any other ways in which doing telehealth across state lines would be relevant?
No, I think this is kind of, we covered permanent resident of somebody, the college students, and the traveler. I think this is kind of the three main areas. There must be many more, but I think this is kind of the three archetypal area. One is clear, that they reside in the state where the traveling thing is clear, still in California, even though they travel. The resident of another state is clear. And then we have the middle ground one where we are not sure yet.
So then I think a lot, too, about the different forms of telemental health. And I wonder about issues of confidentiality. Especially, I like Skype, because with Skype, I have the ability to see my client and my client can see me. And for me, having some doing some special work with body psychotherapy, the physical cues are very important. But I wonder about the confidentiality of that.
You know, this is a million-dollar question in our field, and the debate is raging about whether Skype is HIPAA-compliant, whether it's appropriate means to deliver psychotherapy. And so there are three areas that we need to look at when we look at the relationship about are we allowed to use Skype and is Skype is HIPAA compliant. One, the issue of encryption, privacy, confidentiality, we can call all this. Second, the HIPAA notion of business associates and the HIPAA Hitch regulation of 2011. Number three is a technological issue of interruption of service. So this is the three areas we need to look at.
So I'm not very techie, and I think maybe some of our listeners are not very techie either. And can you say a little bit more about how do we know if Skype uses encryption? How do we know that?
Okay. Yes, Skype uses Advanced Encryption Standard, AES, what we call encryption. In fact, Skype relies on the same type of encryption used by the United States government to protect secret information. As a matter of fact, Skype-to-Skype voice, video, and instant message conversation are likely to be more secure than conventional phone conversation on landline or cellular network. That means with all the debates it's raging, bottom line is Skype is more secure with its encryption system than our phone lines. Skype uses a maximum 256-byte encryption. Skype utilized, I just throw some technological things that you don't need to remember or do anything with, utilize
the AES. It helps to hear the words.
Yeah. It utilizes the AES encryption protocol, which meets the Federal Information Processing Standard, FIPS, for electronic transmission under HIPAA. And then come the second related question of, is Skype encryption accepted by HIPAA standard? And what we need to know is that HIPAA does not have an encryption standard. They don't have an encryption requirement per se. The mandate issues of protection of PHI, of unauthorized access, and issues of confidentiality, and all, they have a lot of intentionality, but they don't tell us how to do it. HIPAA is technologically neutral. So
will it always be neutral? It surprises me. HIPAA has been around for how many years now?
2003.
And it surprises me very much that it's not more specific. Is that intentional? Will it always be less specific? Or is it just that it hasn't caught up with what's happening today?
No, it was actually intentional of their. They decided not to be specific because they didn't want to favor one technology of protecting information over others. So they are intentionally did not get into the which businesses will become multi-billionaires because of HIPAA. So they don't mandate specific technologies. Again, I would like to mention that several experts notice that it's harder to hack into Skype than most into telephone, and much, much harder to hack into Skype than to hack into your conversation with your client by listening behind the door, which is kind of a non-technical, non-techie approach to hacking, or just putting a simple, silly recording device in your office without your knowledge. So, again, hacking into Skype requires high expertise and skills. Hacking into Skype is much harder than simpler low-tech technologies that I just mentioned. So this is the answer. Skype does not tell us that we must encrypt. It implies that we need to use technologies such as encryption.
HIPAA,
yeah.
That's very reassuring, very interesting and very reassuring. I have not personally had this happen to me, but I have talked to colleagues who have occasionally had problems where they're working with a client on Skype and it's a very critical moment where perhaps the person is paranoid or they might be suicidal. And
you know, let me backtrack Skype a little bit. There was something else I wanted to mention. Sorry to interrupt you.
It's okay.
But let me just say a little bit more about Skype and HIPAA. And there are venues that will give you a platform of video conferencing that they say that they are HIPAA compliant. Some of the biggest complaints about or concerns with Skype is that it doesn't say on his website they are HIPAA compliant. And they also don't say that they are business, they're ready to give you a business associate agreement. So they are outfits that are willingly to give you a position themselves clearly as different than Skype that says, I will give you a business associate agreement that Skype does not offer. And then one could argue that psychotherapists do not have a HIPAA business agreement with Verizon or the AT&T or the phone company. And even though we talk to our clients on confidential issues every day. And we never occurred to us that we need a business associate agreement with AT&T or Verizon, whoever is your phone company. And even somebody said, you know, we send letters, confidential letters via the mail. It never occurred to us to ask the U.S. Postal Services or UPS to sign a business associate agreement under HIPAA. So the question is, and this is a valid argument about a business associate, but also there's a counter argument. This is one incredible gray area that a lot of people are, as you said, already using Skype in telehealth, and the experts kind of split and feeling hot on both sides. And I feel actually I'm feel comfortable standing in the middle and asking the right questions. Now back to you drop calls. Why don't you bring the question
again? Can I ask you a question, Ofer?
Sure.
When you think about this whole issue of telehealth and confidentiality and all of the significant questions that are attached to it, what percentage would you say is still gray area?
I'm not sure what percentage, but it's a lot, and the gray area will continue to go as technologies develop and new gray area coming up, which is something we need to continue to have tolerance to in a field that doesn't tolerate much ambiguity. And it's like you and I have been writing about touch. People, you know, some touch is essential to healing and to calming people. Other touch is sexualized and unethical and illegal. And so kind of people just need to learn the differences and to apply it right. And there's something similar around technology. There'd be a lot of gray area.
I think what is so different, though, about that is, and I agree with what you're saying, but I think what's so different about that, especially for those of us who are digital immigrants, is that touch is something that we were born into. And so it does not seem new or unusual and unfamiliar. And still, yes, I would agree. It's a topic that has a lot of gray area in it. But for those of us who are immigrants, this whole digital age is brand new to us. So it's completely unfamiliar, and it's changing at every moment, every day, and affecting how we do therapy and how we run our practices. So it has that additional challenge of adaptation.
That's fair. Yeah, that's fair. Yeah. So welcome to a world of challenges and adaptation.
So I was asking you about dropped Skype with critical clients.
You know, technology is not perfect. What we need to do about potential dropped calls is to do two things. Make a clinical judgment. Is it the right clients for this technology, which you need to do anyway? Secondly, inform the clients that the possibilities that the calls may drop. When cell phone got into the picture, and there were a lot of dropped calls with cell phone, probably the video technologies, the audiovisual technologies will be improving. And I don't see too much of a big deal about it. And you need to do two things, clinical judgment and inform the client. So if the client is very paranoid, you talk to them ahead of time. If the call is dropped, it's not because I hanged up on you. I don't understand why people write long articles about it. It sounds pretty simple issue for me.
So I wonder, is it important or necessary to have a written and signed informed consent that is different if you're using telemental health in any way than just what you have in your regular office policies and procedures?
I think you can. It can. There are two ways. In California, you must have a separate informed consent. This is a kind of mandate, and again, does not cover phone conversation. I think that informed consent, whether you integrate it into your existing one or create a new one, depends on your organization, professional organization, or the state. But it's a good idea where you can talk about the vulnerability of the system, issues of confidentiality, issues that we perhaps won't have that clear, quick access to local calls. If I treat somebody from San Diego, I may not be as familiar with the local psych hospitals, even though I should know some. And so we need to talk about issues of availability, and how available we are to our clients. If we do use chats or use text or we use emails. So to be office policies and informed consent is not always need to be signed. Some states mandate it, some ethics code may be mandating it, but generally I look at informed consent as a conversation, as a work in progress. It's not just limited to this one document. It's very important, and all my clients sign the informed consent before I start treating them. And I have the 61 clinical forms online that thousands of people have been using over the years. But we need to think about informed consent as work in progress, as a dialogue, as a conversation, because more things will come up, and clients will need to make more informed consent as we move along.
This is a little bit different topic, but do we know which modality of telemental health is? Would it be the telephone that people use most frequently?
It's really all over the place. People use Skype, as you mentioned, tons of that. People use a phone. People use emails, increased number. The young ones prefer text, so we see more people using text. And while I cannot think easily about how to do psychoanalysis or psychodynamic therapy via text, as a cognitive therapist can use text. Some people use apps right now in conjunction to psychotherapy. So it depends. And some people will benefit from different formats. My sense, the young ones, really, text will be, that's a way what they move around the world. And this will be an increasingly modality, even though it's hard for us, some of us digital immigrants, to think about use of text in psychotherapy. Virtual life is a growing potentiality because there is so much potentiality. We won't get a chance to talk about it, but there is an incredible opportunity in the virtual reality, have been used in the military successfully with post-traumatic stress disorder, desensitizing, all kind of application for virtual reality. So the sky's the limit, and the different clients may benefit from different approaches.
It's so exciting. Just the possibilities and the potential. This is just a quick question. You know, one of the things about Skype is that you're seeing the person that you're talking to. So you know, for example, how old they are. Where I could see on some of the other modalities, and we have different laws and regulations for children, adolescents, and adults. How do I know if I don't see the person that I'm actually dealing with an adult, that I'm giving therapy to an adult?
This is a very good question about verification. How do we verify that who we are working with? I think it's important to know if it's a minor or not minor. That's for sure, because almost all states have laws about who can we treat with or without parental consent. And but then when it comes to adult, I have never ID'd any clients that tell me that his name is Joe Smith and he lives in Petaluma and he'll fill the forms in Petaluma, and I trust it. I never ask to verify, and I don't know too many people
But Joe Smith looked like he could be 17 or 19, what would you do?
Exactly. This is when you really need to get verification of age, because some of it you need to get parental consent. So if there is potentiality that this client is a child, and if you do text, you wouldn't know it unless you find a way to verify it. And people have kind of whether scanning document and sending to you, independent verification. It's a field that is really still shifting right now, and we don't know, but you need to have it on your map that you may need to verify.
With what you just said to me, I wouldn't know how to do that.
You know, I don't know how to, I don't think this is one way to do that. Kind of showing ID in teleconferencing is one way. Getting a signed consent from a parent.
A picture ID.
Say it again.
A picture ID?
A picture ID that you show in the video conferencing in a way you put it next to the camera where I can read and I can see the picture.
And you'd have to put your face up right by it because you could be holding anybody's ID up. I'm probably getting too stuck on one little.
It's a verification.
Point.
And there's many other ways to verify, and to get the signatures online and all kind of legal ways to verify. And we won't be able to get into that because it can be very technical. But the issue is a very, very important one.
So then I think, too, about as an immigrant, I think a lot of us immigrant psychotherapists pay a lot of attention to body language, vocal, visual cues. And my hunch is that the digital generation is less attached to that. Is that true?
They are. Because they do so much via text and they find some way to put the emotion into the text, and they do used to do more with email, it's really primarily right now with text and Facebook. This is how they communicate. So they are not relying on much facial cues. You're absolutely right. And my sense is that it's maybe kind of just one modality. I personally do not really focus on facial cues. So sometimes use intuition and use other cues, sound, music, and other considerations. So, but if visual cues are very important for you, audiovisual will be better for you as a therapist.
Question is, what are the competence and scope of practice considerations that are relevant to telehealth?
What we know about competence, that it has to do with experience, supervision or consultation, as well as education. What's important for us to know that education is not necessarily only formal education in school. It can be a continuing education course as this one that we are recording here for, as well as you reading books or even going to Wikipedia or going to YouTube to learn about certain modalities. So competence, it's not necessarily something that is formal in the world, in the university. It's something you can gain just by getting CDs or going online and doing your own searches. So you can gain competence, or the education part of the competence does not need to be formal.
Do we know much about the scientific basis of telehealth practices?
We'll need 10 more hours to talk about it. We have thousands of research finding about the efficacy of telehealth, including psychoanalysis, including a therapeutic alliance, and endless treatment modalities to treat endless numbers of DSM and other DSM disorders and mental conditions. So we have tons of the research. The resources page in the book will guide you to some bibliographies that are exclusively on the efficacy of telehealth. Perhaps we can remind ourselves that we had the phone crisis line for over 50 years and saved probably hundreds of thousands of lives, if not millions, and the efficacy has been proven even before the internet was around. So yes, we have the data.
Are there specific guidelines regarding how we as therapists should maintain records of video conferencing, text messages, chats, emails, and other kinds of digital communications with clients?
A very, very good question. Emails are easy to document. Just keep keep the email on your computer. You can print it or not. You don't need to print it. It can be in digital form, of course. And when it comes to audio conferencing or text where you don't keep them, it's like a clinical record of a session, of a regular standard session. You just record what was treated, what was presented, what was the outcome, was it effective. So it's not basically any difference. And so if somebody just emailed to me appointment change or text appointment change, does not have big clinical significance. But if we talk about suicidal or talk about other issues, of course I document it. So basically there is more venues to keep records, because actually you can even texting, you can really print right now. You can have a software that will print it, a voicemail. You can transcribe online, but you need to make sure that these things are encrypted and protected if you're going to use some of these technologies.
You know, this is a records question, but it goes back to the prior question. If I, for example, do a self-study on a certain topic by finding articles online, etc., is it good to document that in my records?
Not necessarily, but if you develop an expertise in a certain area, it would be good just to somewhere to rely on some documentation. But it would be something that if you are ever being asked, you would be tested to. We don't have a standard of care or how to document that you read all these books. And you don't need necessarily to get obsessively to note it. It won't hurt, of course, to note using a certain kind of therapy and citing some of the top people in the field in the clinical record. But it's not really necessary to be kind of a very high level of compliance with the standard of care. But the standard of care is pretty minimum, and we don't have a requirement of all the books and CDs that you wrote. If you're being asked, you should be able to answer it.
I've talked to some other colleagues who have voiced concerns that opening your clients to working with specifically email or text gives them the unrealistic expectation that they have 24/7 access to you. What are your thoughts on that?
It's part of the informed consent. They may have expectation. It's something that I talk to my clients, and the young ones do have expectation of immediacy and speediness of text communication 24/7. And I talk to them about my availability or inavailability. My office policy said that Dr. Zur may not be available for weeks at a time for phone, email, text, and any other communication. So when I climb Kilimanjaro, or I'm on a glacier in Alaska, or I travel in China, I'm not available. And so it's part of the informed consent that I tell them about my level of availability. And some people are available. Some people will text 24/7 to the client. So it's a conversation that will adjust the expectation.
As an ethics expert, would you say that we need a special, additional or different code of ethics or guidelines for telehealth, or can it adequately be covered by the existing practice guidelines and professional code of ethics?
It's another great question. There are two approaches. Some, like American Counseling Association and other organizations, decided to develop special guidelines and ethics code for telehealth. APA, American Psych Association, so far has stated that whatever in the code applies to digital communication as well. I see benefits and kind of and downfalls on both approaches, and there's no one right way to do that. So either one is really fine, but I don't see a necessary requirement. I think APA approach is reasonable. The issue of fidelity and confidentiality and loyalty and do no harm all apply to our relationship with our clients, regardless whether we practice digital or telehealth or online therapy or not.
Wilfred, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you today. It's been so informative and enlightening. Thank you so much. But before we end, can you tell us what are your general recommendations for mental health practitioners who are interested in engaging in telehealth?
to recap a little bit kind of what we say today, you know, I said please get education regarding the clinical, ethical, legal, and technological aspect of telemental health. Attend very carefully to cross state lines that you ask me about. As we discussed before, tolerate some of the ambiguity that there's a lot of that we don't know yet. Consult, consult, and consult. And when you consult, you may get opposite opinions, and then you need to make an informed decision. Have a good consent form. Verify the identity of the client. Make an assessment of risk and benefit analysis regarding using telehealth with certain clients in certain situations for certain disorders. So telehealth is not for everybody. It's not for all clients. It's not for all therapists. Pay attention to crisis and emergency issues, issues of dangerousness, duty to warn, because it may not be in the community. You may have different kind of laws and regulation where the client is at. Be aware of local resources, again, for emergency. Make sure that your insurance coverage and liability coverage and malpractice are covered by your insurance company. Remain aware of the limitation of online services and the technologies that we discussed before, dropped calls, etc. Evaluate the effectiveness of your treatment because you may think it's appropriate for you, appropriate for the client, or appropriate for the situation, but it may not. So it's kind of a work in progress of the appropriate and the efficacy. Practice within your scope of practice. You ask me about competence, so become competent if you choose to do that. Attend to the cultural and ethical and language and other differences that may affect digital communication that you have brought up, better body language, intonation, etc. Ensure both clinical and technological competence, really, really important. And tolerate not to know and enjoy these fantastic new opportunities.
Thank you, Ofer. It's great to be a pioneer with you. And I'm looking forward to learning more from you as the knowledge opens up in this field. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Nola. You're a great interviewer. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.